Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 7th, 2018, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria, and we have a great show for you this week. Would I ever not have a great show for you? Don't think so. But again, let's talk about how we make these great, great shows. It's me, but I also have help, you guys. I have a great editor, and I also have an assistant who helps out from time to time. And the only way that I can, you know, pay these people and give this big chunk of time from my schedule, you know, aside from giving talks and working on my TV shows and, oh yeah, being back in school, woohoo, it is from the support from listeners like yourself. You'll notice that this week I'm not reading any ads. That's not uncommon. Sometimes I only read one, not two. Ads, of course, help support the show, but I'd say that my main support, about at least half, if not more, comes from you, the listeners. And the easiest way to do it is to visit patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support. Because again, I have this model for a reason. I want my show to always be free. I'm never going to charge for you to listen to it. And so I think that the best way, the fairest way, is that the people who can afford to and who want to show their support, they can pledge it, you know, and it really runs the gamut there. You're supporting on an episodic basis as you can. So like my number one supporter this week is Rob Schreck. Oh my gosh, Rob, I hope you don't mind me sharing this, but $100 an episode, just amazing. And of course, I have a supporter who's paying 25 cents an episode. So it really runs the gamut. Like I said, it takes all types, and all of you guys make the show go round. So let me thank my top supporters this week, including, like I said, Rob Schreck. Oh my gosh, thank you so much. Also, Phil T. Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, The Honorable Husband. Love it. That's honorable with a U, in case you didn't know. Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and of course, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you all so, so very much. Okay, no ads, so let's dive right into it. This week, I got to interview a fascinating writer. He is best known probably for his 2004 book Shadow Divers. He's also written Crashing Through and Pirate Hunters. But this week we focus on his newest book. It's called Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. Guys, this one is so very interesting. Robert Kersen is an incredible storyteller, and you'll be able to tell from the interview just how fascinating this story is and just how much he captures your imagination. And of course, the book is even better than this hour that I got to spend with him. So I highly recommend you check it out. And just to prove to you why you're going to love it, without any further ado, here he is, Robert Kersen. Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Kara. It's an honor to be with you.
It is an honor to have this book in my hands, because I have to say, this is such an exciting story that you've chosen to tell, all about Apollo 8. So I think before we even start to talk about that story, I would love to know, are you a space travel file? Like, what is it that made you want to dedicate so much time and energy to the journalism required to tell this story?
Well, it was really a happy accident for me. I live in Chicago, and I was at the Museum of Science and Industry, one of our great institutions here. And I was showing friends the U-boat that they have on display there, which happens to be a perfect match for the one I wrote about in my first book, which is called Shadow Divers, to German World War II U-boat. So I showed friends this, and I was heading out of the museum, and I kind of stumbled across this space capsule, which looked at once to have come from the past and the future. It was the coolest thing I think I'd ever seen. It was definitely scarred and battered from wherever it had gone. And I read the placard, and the placard said this was the Apollo 8 space capsule, the command module.
Wow.
I loved space when I was a little kid. You know how they would stop class in grade school when I was a little kid, and they would turn on the black and white TV that was bolted to the wall, and we would watch the Apollo astronauts. But I kind of lost track of the whole thing. But I was surprised that I didn't know anything about Apollo 8. I knew about Apollo 11, which was man's first landing on the moon. And I knew about Apollo 13, which was the one commanded by James Lovell, that had an explosion near the moon and almost didn't make it back. But I knew nothing about Apollo 8. So I went home and I started to read about it. And Kara, within about, I'd say 15 minutes, I knew that I was reading about the greatest space story ever told, and maybe the greatest exploration story in mankind's history. It had everything. It was so thrilling. It was man's first journey away from home and man's first arrival at a new world, the first trip for mankind to the moon. It was every single aspect of a thrilling story you could want. It had. It had an existential arch enemy. It had a race against time. It had all kinds of danger, impossible challenges, incredibly interesting main characters. And the more I read, the more fascinated I became. And one of the things that told me I was onto something incredible was that when I started to listen to interviews with other astronauts, including Neil Armstrong, they spoke reverentially about Apollo 8, and they seemed to speak about it, at least to my ear, in a way that they didn't speak about any other space mission, including their own. When I heard Neil Armstrong talk about Apollo 8, it sounded like he considered Apollo 8 to be even greater leap for mankind than his own mission. And that's when I knew that this is a once-in-a-lifetime story.
Oh, I love that. So why do you think that it is? And I mean, I guess we'll probably hit on this throughout our conversation today. But why do you think that it is that in many ways it has sort of, I don't know, been a bit buried in history? I mean, the information is there, of course, but, you know, through film and through books, you're right. Apollo 11 and Apollo 13 definitely, I think, have taken the spotlight.
Right. Well, in its day, Apollo 8 went at the very end of 1968. And when they returned, it was the biggest story in the world. So it certainly wasn't overlooked at the time. Mm-hmm. But over the years, the landing on the moon, something about setting foot on the moon captured people's imagination, as we could all well understand. And then the excitement and danger and near tragedy of Apollo 13 took over. But as the years went on, people mostly seemed to remember those two, 11 and 13. And I think one of the great losses for many generations is the sort of forgotten mission of Apollo 8, which really, as I said, is the greatest of all the missions.
Oh, so I'm so excited to dive into this then. Apollo 8 happened, when was this, 1968?
Right at the end of 1968, which is really one of the worst years in American history for so many reasons.
What are some of those reasons to remind my perhaps younger listenership?
Well, 1968 is a year of terrible violence and division and strife in the United States. There are two terrible assassinations, Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy. There's violence in the streets, including in my hometown of Chicago at the Democratic National Convention, where the police are beating protesters terribly and violently and brutally. 15,000 American lives will be lost in 1968 in Vietnam, including in the Tet Offensive. So often, Kara, 90% or more of the evening network news is devoted to Vietnam. There's tremendous racial division. There's a terrible response by authority figures to protests. It seems that the entire country is divided against itself and that nothing can bring America back together again. In fact, there are some echoes in 2018 to what happened in 1968, where it just seemed nobody could come together on anything. And by the end of the year, when Apollo 8 is ready to go, many are considering 1968 one of the worst, if not the worst, years in American history.
So, of course, this paints a picture of a population that's feeling quite dejected, that's not feeling very inspired, to say the least. But the Apollo program at this point was not brand new. I mean, we're talking Apollo 8. Does that refer, or does that imply that there were seven previous mission attempts?
No, it doesn't. Apollo 1, which was supposed to go early in 1967, ended in tragedy on the launch pad during a test in which a fire broke out in the command module and killed all three astronauts. So the Apollo program starts off in a terrible, terrible disaster. And it's enough that Congress is seriously considering ending the entire Apollo program. NASA gets through that, but there's a heavy weight on its shoulders to perform flawlessly after that. And also, there's terrible tragedy that's permeating among the astronauts, and especially astronauts' families and wives, who saw these three brave, very strong men trapped inside and die in this command module. Apollo 2 and 3 don't go. There is really no Apollo 2 and 3. And then Apollo 4 and 6 are tests of the Saturn V rocket this mighty machine, by the way, which is still the most powerful machine ever built to this day. And Apollo 5 is a test, an unmanned test. So really, the manned Apollo flights start with Apollo 7 in later 1968.
Wow. Okay. So this really was, in some ways, after that tragedy, the first kind of, I don't know, not actual attempt, but the first potential to really bring the country together and get them excited. And of course, at this point, we're talking full-on space race, no?
Yes, absolutely. And it's a space race against the Soviet Union that's been going on since at least 1957, when they launched Sputnik, the first man-made satellite ever. And the space race has great existential implications. Mm-hmm. The side that wins the space race not just proves or seems to prove to the world that its science and technology and way of life are superior, but they make a big leap in controlling what is possibly the ultimate battlefield in the world, which is space. Because if you can put men in space and deliver men to the moon, then you can put soldiers in space and military bases perhaps on the moon. So this is a huge, huge thing to get the first men to the moon. And it's really an existential proposition. We believe, and so does the Soviet Union, that our very existence is at stake in doing this. And for a long time, the Soviet Union is in front of the United States in this. But the real test is who can get the first men to the moon.
Do you think, when you look back at the reporting that you did, digging through the history, do you think that the kind of passion and the experience and the mentality of the general public was perfectly in line with the mentality that we often speak about of the government and their intentions at the time? Were the people, the American people, fully caught up in the space race for the same reasons? Or was it really just about exploration and excitement and maybe getting ahead of the Russians? But for them, was it a live or die kind of situation?
I don't think it was quite as live or die for the general public as it was for NASA and the government, but it certainly had some of that. And you would see on magazine covers the space race depicted as a real, literal race to the moon between the two sides. So everybody was very cognizant of it. Mm. There are those military implications, and we're having a terrible military time of it in Vietnam at the same time. So the idea that we might come out ahead in something as important as the space race is very important to the general public, but they also see it as something incredibly romantic and thrilling. You know, here we've dreamed really for millennia of reaching our most ancient companion, the moon, but it's always just out of reach, it seems. It's so beautiful and it's hung there so brilliantly lit at night, and yet we just can't reach it. And all of a sudden, NASA says, not only can we reach it, but we may land there and we may do it very, very soon. And the idea of that is thrilling to people. Come 1968.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the actual mission. There were three astronauts involved, correct?
Correct. Frank Borman, who is going to be the commander of the mission and is one of NASA's very finest astronauts. Jim Lovell, who we would know later on from Apollo 13. And Bill Anders, who would be making his first space flight. Borman and Lovell had flown together for 14 days, if you can believe that, on Gemini 7 in a capsule the size of the front seat of a Volkswagen Beetle, 14 days together. Actually, when they came up on the recovery ship, Lovell said, "We'd like to announce our engagement." That's how close the quarters were. So they really liked each other and were very familiar. And then they had Bill Anders, a very young guy who Borman saw much in his image. And these three guys were tasked with making mankind's first journey to the moon.
So I remember a little bit about the Gemini missions, and these really were, like you said, these tiny little capsules that these guys were orbiting the Earth in. How different was the Apollo enclosure, the area where they were to spend time? Because it's a longer mission than Gemini for sure.
Well, this one would be shorter than Gemini 7. The journey planned for Apollo 8 would be less than 7 days, 6 days and a fraction. But the reason they went for 14 days on Gemini 7 was the outer limit of what it was thought a lunar mission might take. So they wanted to prove on that mission that humans could survive that long. But by comparison, the Apollo command module seemed like a palatial compared to Gemini. But just to show you how small all this was, no matter what, the Apollo command module, which would hold three people, not two like the Gemini, was only 11 feet tall by 13 feet wide at its base. And that's for three men on a 6.5-day mission to the moon.
Oh, that sounds horrible. They must have, I mean, I hope they really, really liked each other.
I think they very much liked each other. Borman got a sense early on. He told me that he believed he had the finest crew ever assembled at NASA. So, and they would need it because the risks and the dangers they were incurring for this spaceflight were unlike any before or after.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those. So we've got these three guys, and they're signing up for really uncharted territory. They are the first guys to, not to attempt, but to actually end up going to the moon. And they're doing this in the face of this failed attempt just the year before.
Right. And not only are they going to go in the face of that failed attempt, they're going to go very suddenly and all at once. In August, early August of 1968, this mission for Apollo 8 did not exist. Apollo 8 was supposed to be a very conservative Earth orbital mission. But all of a sudden, in early summer of 1968, NASA changed the mission to something almost unbelievably daring. They decided that Apollo 8 should go not just into Earth orbit, or not even 853 miles above Earth, which was the current altitude record, but 240,000 miles away to the moon. And not just around the moon, but to orbit the moon 10 times. The thing was rushed so quickly, and for reasons that are just astonishing when you start to find out about them. But what it required was that Apollo 8 be made ready, that the astronauts train, that the engineers perfect everything, that the software be written, and all kinds of other calculations made and training done in just 4 months, when a normal space mission would take 12 to 18 months of training. So not only were we looking to compress this into an impossibly short time, they were going to do it on the man's first flight to the moon, which had never been attempted before. It was seemed insane, and it was so crazy. And I can explain a lot of the reasons why, but just to give you an idea of how crazy it was, when the head of NASA, James Webb, first heard the idea, he said, and this is a quote, "Are you out of your mind?" And he pointed out to the second in command that if anything happened to these astronauts, if they died at the moon, if they crashed into the moon, if they flew off into eternal solar orbit, or any of the other things that seemed likely to happen to this sudden flight, nobody would ever look at the moon the same again. And there was something else in what he was saying. It's not just that they would not look at the moon the same again. They would never look at Christmas the same way again, because Apollo 8 was scheduled to orbit the moon on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day of 1968.
Wow. Okay. And so do you think that these guys, you know, they had to have an algorithm in their heads, a bit of a calculus, the same as anybody when they take on a large risk? Like, I mean, not many people have taken on a risk like this, but do you think that they fully expected that they were not going to make it through this mission?
I think they all understood that that was a distinct possibility. Borman and Lovell did not put it into statistical terms. And when I asked about them, they said, "We don't think like that, and we wouldn't go if we didn't think we had a really terrific chance." But Bill Anders was very candid with me about the chances of a successful mission. He told me, he said what he told his wife the day he got the assignment. He said he believed there was a 1/3 chance of a successful mission, a 1/3 chance that the mission didn't succeed, but that they somehow made it back to Earth alive, and a 1/3 chance they didn't get back at all. And so this is what they were facing, and on a rush basis and against so many odds, everything, Kara, was going to be for the first time in this flight. Neil Armstrong said, by the time we went on Apollo 11, Apollo 8 had proved so much of what we needed to know. But when Apollo 8 went, nobody knew if any of it could be done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was a Hail Mary in so many ways. And that's not to say that they didn't do amazing work. Obviously, we now know from hindsight that they did amazing work in that very shortened time period, but there must have been so many unknowns.
Some of the unknowns are so staggering that even 50 years later, it boggles the mind to think of it. I'll give you two of them, for example. Mm-hmm. The first is that Apollo 8 was going to fly the Saturn V rocket. Now, that's the only rocket powerful enough to deliver men to the moon in 1968. But Saturn V had only been flown twice, both times without humans aboard. So it had only been tested twice. And in its second test, it failed catastrophically. So only the third flight of the Saturn V ever, this monstrous beast that would generate 160 million horsepower at launch, that was going to fly with three human beings who had children and wives at home. And the most recent test was a disaster. Also, remember that Apollo 8 is going to go without the lunar module. That's the spidery landing craft that would, you know, land Armstrong and Aldrin on the moon on Apollo 11. So they're not going to land on the moon. They're just going to orbit 10 times over 20 hours, and they're going without the lunar module. But the lunar module had a secondary function, and that was as a backup engine. So that if anything went wrong at the moon for Apollo 8 and its single engine failed or malfunctioned, there was no backup. They were reliant on a single engine. If anything went wrong, they could be stuck at the moon forever. They could crash into the lunar surface, fly off into eternal solar orbit, or any other number of terrible results. So there's no redundancy for them at the moon. And just those two things alone, almost unthinkable now in the days of triple redundancy and quadruple redundancy. They were just going almost blindfolded in certain ways.
Gosh, I have to say, like, I don't have the right stuff. I think about what it would take to sign up for something like this. And don't get me wrong. I mean, these men weren't just signing up for NASA. They had been there. They had been with the organization a while. You know, when I think about modern astronauts, they generally come from two camps. You've got your scientists turned astronauts, and then you've got kind of your military or like fighter pilot type guys turned astronauts. What were the three men that were involved in this mission?
These are all military pilots and the best of the best, really, in the world. Borman was a test pilot and a fighter pilot, Lovell a test pilot, and Anders a fighter pilot. And they were just, you know, always consistently ranked at the very top of their classes. They were testing and flying the most cutting-edge machines ever built, often machines that had not been proven yet. So they were wired differently than most of the rest of us. They did have the right stuff, and NASA really knew who to look for. You know, if they had picked people who processed some of the risks in the way you and I might, nobody would have ever climbed aboard the Saturn V 363 feet into the air aboard a rocket with the power of a small nuclear bomb. You can't think, well, I have children at home and I have a wife and people depend on me. If you're wired to think that way, like the most of the rest of us are, nobody would have ever launched. So they picked these guys who had already proven their willingness to go into the unknown.
And let's take a minute to just think back. And I know it's probably very tough for some of my listeners, especially if you are in my kind of age cohort. I was born in 83. I'm 30. I'll be 35 this year. So, of course, that's two decades after this took place. But thinking back two decades before I was born, there was no internet. There were no advanced technologies. There were no real like computers, at least not personal computers, the way that we know of them now. And the joke that we often hear is that we sent men to the moon with less computing power than what you carry around in your back pocket. Is that actually true?
I just spoke to Bill Anders about this a few days ago, and he told me that he just bought a little digital watch. He paid less than $100 for it. Mm-hmm. And he said that watch has more computing power than the entire command module had that they rode to the moon on Apollo 8, and that his iPhone, and I think his iPhone's a couple generations old already, has more computing power than mission control had all combined at their hands when Apollo 8 flew.
How is this possible? And of course, you keep saying, you just talked to these guys. We know that they made it through unscathed. That doesn't mean that there wasn't stress along the way, but they've also lived long and healthy lives. I mean, I can't wrap my head around. It must have been almost as much art as it was science at the time.
Yeah. And in addition to the art and science, you have to build in a healthy dose of faith because, again, nobody had ever done this. And I don't mean religious faith. I mean more faith in the minds of the engineers and the scientists and the managers at NASA. Frank Borman told me that he had discovered that the average age of the trajectory specialists who plotted their course to the moon was 24 when Apollo 8 went. So you had to have a real good dose of faith, not just in the human mind, but in American ingenuity and hard work.
It's interesting. I wonder how much of that, it's kind of unquantifiable. We talk about this a lot in psychology, which is the field that I'm working in now. And in psychological research, you often talk about constructs, you know, different tests and different measures. Try and tap into a construct. And a construct is really just how we describe some sort of thought or behavior or perspective or perception. And so it's so hard to really quantify the mix of personality traits, the mix of perspectives that would be required of somebody with the fortitude to sign up for a mission like this. But there's got to be some amount of like just being naive. No, there's got to be some amount of just like, yeah, I'm not really thinking completely through all the risks, because if I did, I would stop in my tracks.
I talked to Jim Lovell about this at length, and I tried to press him on it. And he often said to me, I just don't think that way. And, you know, I said, yeah, but you got to understand that the risks. And he said, that's just not how I think. And finally, I started to take him at his word that he really doesn't think that way. Now, you're not going to meet a more brilliant guy than Jim Lovell. You know, all these guys, in addition to their incredible piloting skills and their incredible military commitment, they're all brilliant academics as well. You had mm-hmm. to be really terrific on every level to make it through as an astronaut in those days. It's now as well, of course. But Jim Lovell was telling me the truth. He didn't think about it like that. Or when I would ask Frank Borman, Frank would explain to me at great length how difficult life was on his wife, Susan, who came to believe with 100% certainty, not more likely than not, not probable, but with 100% certainty that Frank would die during Apollo 8. He said mm-hmm. her stress began early, like it did for many of the wives, when they would be on Air Force bases or naval bases and see black clouds in the sky and know that a pilot had died, and they would just wait to see whose house the black car would pull up to an hour later to deliver the bad news. And so when I asked Frank, well, how did it make you feel when you saw your friends die in midair collisions or right beside you? And he said, you know, maybe it doesn't make me sound so great, but I would just think to myself, that dumb son of a bitch killed himself. I'm better than him.
Wow.
And he said, that's the way he thought. And if you stop to think about it, if you didn't think that way and you started to contemplate it, because oftentimes it wasn't the guy's fault, it just was the way things were. Mm-hmm. If you thought too much about it and you didn't think like Frank Borman thought, you probably wouldn't get in the cockpit of an airplane that had never really been tested before.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, you've got to think about sort of what was at stake for the different players here. What was at stake for the wives was destruction and loss of their family. And of course, it probably made the most sense for them to expect the worst, because they didn't, not that there was nothing required of them if the worst did happen, if tragedy struck. Obviously, they would be there to pick up the pieces. There would be so much media attention on them. They would, you know, really have a hard time. But expecting the worst probably made it easier to bear. Whereas the men, they simply couldn't expect the worst, because if they did, then they wouldn't be ready to fulfill the mission.
No, you couldn't climb into those airplanes, and certainly not on top of rockets, expecting the worst. You had to basically expect the best. Otherwise, I think you probably couldn't function. But the wives were under tremendous stress. And we talked a moment about the Apollo 1 fire, and it devastated the families, especially the family of Ed White. His wife was never the same after that. And Susan Borman was very good friends with Pat White, Ed White's wife. And Pat White, down the road, ended up taking her own life. These are wow. stresses and results that can devastate generations. And the wives knew that. And not only did they have to deal with it, but they believed it was their duty to make it very clear to their husbands that they weren't dealing with it, and that their lives were just fine, and everything mm-hmm. was peaceful and happy at home, because that's the only way their husbands could concentrate with full force and attention on the job at hand.
Oh, man. And of course, there was kind of a certain component of being a product of that generation as well, right? There were very specific gender roles at the time. I think they were just on the cusp of being challenged. And, there, you know, we were just on a cusp of a big kind of gender revolution. But at the time, we really still were kind of trapped in an older way of thinking. And so that would just feed into the expectations of these women as well. I mean, so fascinating that you dug deep into the history of both the main characters, the main actors in this, you know, basically this real life drama, but also all of the characters around them and supporting them, because of course their stories were central.
Well, you know, it took me a very short amount of time to realize that this story needed to be as much about the wives and the families as it was about the astronauts. That the wives, and the way I figured that out was that the astronauts told me so right up front, just how incredibly important the support of their wives was, and the bravery and the courage that these women showed, and that they were every bit the heroes that the men were. And it was really true when you start to think of what was required of these three guys, especially in these 4 months that they were training nonstop to make this historic and really daring mission happen. The wives are holding down everything and allowing the guys to focus. And it's tremendously difficult on them, especially on Susan Borman. And each of the three men spoke so lovingly of their wives. And it was fascinating to me to discover that of all the Gemini crews and the Apollo crews, only the crew of Apollo 8 survived with all of their marriages intact. Being an astronaut was incredibly difficult on relationships and on marriages, as you can imagine. But these three guys really married their childhood sweethearts and had a long history with these heroic women going way back into their youths. So I think that was part of what helped this singular mission survive and succeed. It's hard to imagine talking to any of these three guys today. It's hard to imagine Apollo 8 occurring without the support of their wives.
Which is so fascinating, because I think when we think about kind of a more modern approach to space flight or space travel, we think about what's on our horizon within our generation, which is potentially a mission to Mars. And we look at fictionalizations of this in the media. We often see that the new astronaut with the right stuff is, you know, the man or the woman who is, you know, untethered, who is willing to potentially take a one-way mission, who may have family back at home, but is a little bit rogue, probably doesn't have children, probably doesn't have a serious significant other. But then on the flip side, when you look at, you know, the Andy Weir fictionalization with The Martian, I think he did have a family and a kid, but they really didn't play that up kind of for the camera or for the story there. And I, in a way, I appreciated that, because so many times when these kinds of stories are told, there is this sort of tugging at the heartstrings, this sort of kind of violin aspect of, oh no, the people back at home. But the truth of the matter is, in this era, at this time, that was the scenario. There were people back home desperately waiting to see if they were going to make it through alive.
Right. And there are pictures taken by Life magazine photographers, because they were granted exclusive access to the astronauts' homes and the families. There are pictures that show just how much tension was going on in the house and how locked to the squawk boxes the wives were. You know, the squawk boxes were installed in the homes of the astronauts so that the wives could listen to broadcasts between the spacecraft and mission control. And these women are hanging on these at some times, because just the sound of their husband's voice could reassure them, if only for another 5 minutes or 10 minutes. But then Apollo 8 gets to the far side of the moon, it slips behind the moon, and all transmission goes dead. And these three men are now more disconnected from humanity than anyone has ever been before. Nothing can reach them, no sound can reach them, and you just have to wait. And this happens on 10 revolutions, and it's extremely stressful on the wives back home. The young kids are really the luckiest. They really don't know what's happening. Jim Lovell's youngest puts on a space helmet, and he comes out and talks to the reporters, and every so often, he looks up into the sky to see if he can see the command module flying by. But other than that, it's Christmas time. But for the older kids, and certainly the wives, they know that any number of things could go wrong, because none of this has ever been done before.
Oh, I try to like put myself in that position, and it's hard to say if I would want to be listening the whole time. Obviously, like you said, the reassurance that they feel hearing their husband's voices is so meaningful. But at the same time, there are so many small things that are probably happening. So many, you know, transmissions that might even be normal that probably feel very stressful. You know, maybe one small thing goes wrong that's not that big a deal, but it could feel mission critical at the time. And I just can't imagine the amount of pressure.
Yeah, it was terrible pressure. And the wives told me that the best thing they could hope for when they were listening to the squawk box was really dry, mundane, technical information being discussed, because that meant everything was going normally.
I'm sure. So I think about the Mars Science Laboratory, the Curiosity rover landing more recently. And of course, this is a robot. There are no people on this thing. But there was this experience that was called the 7 minutes of terror. And this is simply because Mars is so incredibly far away that even with the speeds and the technology, kind of the advanced technology that we have now, there's a 7 minute delay from the transmission from the robot back to us here on Earth. Was there a delay in transmission from these Apollo astronauts back to mission control?
Yeah, there was about a 1.5 second delay. And it's fascinating to think that when the astronauts were calling back to Earth, you were hearing voices from the past and not the present. You know, it was a short enough delay, of course, that it was effectively nothing, but it certainly did take about a second and a half between communications. And as you point out so rightly, the farther away you get, the more delay there is. And so talking about Mars is a fascinating thing when you start to build in those kinds of distances.
Oh my goodness, I know, and just all of the unknowns. But of course, what I think we're feeling currently and presently in this excitement about Mars, I'm not even sure if it compares to the kind of tensions and the excitements in the American people, and of course, the people whose lives were directly affected by the Apollo 8 mission, because in a way, it's new, and in a way, it's kind of, you know, it's boldly going where we've never been before, but we've been, like, in essence, we've never been to Mars. I mean, it's going to be incredible if and when it happens, especially if it's successful. But at this point in time, when Apollo 8, you know, took off from that launch pad, we had never been, like, outside of our own orbit or outside of our own atmosphere. Like we had, you know, gone around the Earth a few times. So I guess technically we had left the atmosphere, but we had never gone this far, had we?
No, not close. 853 miles above the Earth's surface was the record. And mankind, for all of its existence, had never left its world. This proposition for Apollo 8 was truly Homeric. It was an odyssey. And when Apollo 8, it finished a couple Earth orbits just to check out that everything was okay. But when it came time to light the third stage engine again, to relight it, and to gain enough speed to leave Earth's gravitational pull and set course for the moon, when that happened, grown men in NASA, one after another, broke down in tears, sobbing. This was something that never had happened before and would never, ever happen again. It's the first time human beings left their home. And it was incredibly moving to these people, many of whom were very stoic scientists who had only grown up in a world of calculations and figures and trajectories, all of a sudden saw the poetry and the deep meaning in this that we had ever since we walked the Earth, we dreamed of leaving. That's in our DNA, I think, to explore and to leave and to push into the unknown. And here, for the first time ever, we'd left home.
Ah, see, I'm getting choked up just you talking about it. And so let's talk about the logistics so that we know exactly what did happen on this mission. So first they take off. And when they take off with this rocket, you said it was the Saturn
Five.
The Saturn V rocket. Is it similar to the way that, you know, we take off now? There it's vertical launch from a launch pad. There are rocket boosters that fall away, or was it a different kind of thing?
No, it's very similar. It uses three stages. The first stage has five incredibly powerful engines that generate 160 million horsepower, enough power to power the entire United Kingdom at peak usage. It was something that they trained for relentlessly in those 4 months, including in simulators, and had the finest technology. But when it started to happen, the violence of the liftoff was so unexpected to the three astronauts that Bill Anders believed that the fins of the rocket were tearing through the launch tower. He thought something was terribly wrong. And yet Frank Borman took his hand off the abort handle. He would have rather died, and he means this literally when he tells you this, he would have rather died than do something wrong. So they're going to go, but they had no concept of the violence and the power and the shaking that was going on in the first 10, 20 seconds of the liftoff. But yes, it's very much like you see now. It loses its first stage. The second stage takes over, and finally the third stage. And the whole idea of the first part of this flight is to get Apollo 8 into Earth orbit, where they can check out all the systems, make sure everything's go, and know that they have a healthy spacecraft for the journey to the moon.
So they're launching with this incredible, ferocious power just to get up to a place where physics takes over and where they're actually in orbit and they don't have to use power to stay into orbit anymore, which, as you just described, takes so much kind of violent power that they were shaking, that it was probably roaring in their ears. how quick is that acceleration? Like, are we talking pushing so many G's that they lose consciousness, or were they able, using like all the techniques they learned, the Valsalvas and everything, to kind of stay alert through that really important part?
No, they were able to stay alert, and it's not the kind of G's that would knock you out, although there are significant G-forces involved. But what happened is the noise was so great and the shaking so thunderous that all three astronauts immediately could not read their instruments. They had, and they could not hear mission control at all. So they were really in the hands of the gods at that point. They could not do anything about anything. If something was going wrong, there's nothing they could have done about it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The violence of the liftoff was so great that Bill Anders' head smashed into his hand, and he cut a gouge in his helmet. And later on, when he removed his helmet, he thought, well, that's what happens to a rookie on a spaceflight. But when he collected the helmets of his two crewmates, they also had deep gouges in there. So it was just no controlling your body. Their arms were too heavy to lift. They were just, they were helpless in the first stages of this flight.
Wow. Okay. So at this point, it's kind of like we said, Hail Mary. It's we're going, and there's nothing we can do about it anyway. We're not going to abort no matter what. And at that point, what would that really do anyway? Once you've taken off, you've taken off. And then eventually they get up to Earth's orbit. How long was that time span from the time that the, you know, engines kind of started roaring to the time that they were in this very different environment?
They're in Earth orbit for a few hours just to check and make sure everything's okay, to make sure the communications with mission control is good. Bill Anders told me that Frank Borman warned him, do not be looking out the window. We're here on business, you know, because he knew that he has a new astronaut aboard.
Mm-hmm.
And all Anders could do was stare out the window. He could not, he could not believe the beauty of what he was seeing. He could see the San Diego coastline where he had gone on his first dates with his wife as a very young couple. But anytime he could steal a glance, he looked. And this was thrilling to him. And he couldn't believe that Borman and Lovell had the luck in Gemini 7 of 14 days of this glorious view, and he was going to get it for just a couple hours before setting course for the moon.
And of course, I think sometimes when we watch footage of the ISS or we watch movies where they try to recreate this kind of low gravity situation, this orbital situation, it seems very like floaty and like womb-like and comfortable, as if, you know, they just went through this violent explosion and now they're in this very peaceful, calm situation. But they are like spinning around the Earth really, really fast, aren't they?
They really are. And Bill Anders thought this was a glorious opportunity to flip and to slide around. And he soon realized that he better stay focused or he might, you know, lose it. And so, so he had to get used to zero gravity. The other two had good experience with it already. But yeah, this was something that was not going to last long around Earth, and they were going to have to get used to speeds coming up to leave Earth that no human had ever traveled at before.
Ugh, okay, so now they're in gravity. They're spinning around the Earth really fast. They're doing several rotations. How many did you say that they did?
I think they did about 2.5 rotations around Earth before they were ready to go.
Okay, so, and you said that took a couple hours.
I can't remember the exact time. I think it's about 90 minutes per revolution, so whatever that would
be. Okay, so about 3 plus 4 hours. So they're spinning around, they're making sure everything's good with the ship, they're making sure that all of their comms are good and that they're ready to move on to the next really most important phase of this mission. And in this phase, they have to kind of launch those boosters yet again, because the only way to get out of low Earth orbit is to use some sort of fuel, right? Some sort of explosion to move forward.
Right. They need power again, and that's going to be delivered by the third stage engine, which will be relit. They lost the first, you know, they jettisoned the first two stages, but the third stage mm-hmm. needs to be relit again, and it has to increase their speed to near 25,000 miles an hour to escape Earth's gravitational pull.
25,000 miles. It's like unfathomable going that fast. Like, I'm sure that at a certain point, you can't tell the difference between 18,000 miles an hour and 25,000 miles an hour. I mean, it just must be so hard to even concentrate, to even focus, to get the work that you need to get done. At that point, they're strapped back in their chairs and they're just holding on for the ride, right?
Exactly.
And so they light their boosters. They're able to move out of Earth's gravity. This part goes off without a hitch.
Yeah, it goes off beautifully. And remember, they don't just light this when they discover that everything's good aboard the spacecraft and at mission control. Everything has to be really done down to the second, because their trajectory to the moon is very precise. They are planning what's called a free return trajectory, which means that if something goes wrong with the engines or with things as they near the moon, they can use lunar gravity and whip around the moon in a figure eight, mm-hmm. and have physics return them to Earth. So this has to be done really precisely. And remember, the moon is way far away from where it's going to be when they get there. So it's like, you know, how hunters will shoot in front of ducks, for example.
Yeah.
So they have to kind of lead the moon, and they have to do it exactly the right kind of speed. And the moon itself is traveling a couple thousand miles an hour. So everything has to be perfect when this third stage engine is relit.
So they're dealing with a moving target, a big moving target. The good news is that it's calculable where it's going to be. And of course, this was part of all of that planning in the months leading up, was doing all of the physics to make sure, like you said, down to the second that they fire those boosters, they move off in the right direction at the exact right time so they get where they need to be. And you mentioned they're going to use sort of a gravity assist to come back, like they're going to sling around the moon. Did they have any options available to them to correct course in case if something went wrong?
Yeah, they could use small boosters or retros to mm-hmm. adjust. I mean, even the discarding of urine on the way could change the whole spacecraft's trajectory. So they needed to do some mid-course corrections. Now, how many they need to do remain to be seen. But yes, they needed to correct. And what they're aiming for is to orbit the moon when they get there at an altitude of just 69 miles. So think about that. They're taking this shot from 240,000 miles away, and they want to get to an altitude of just 69 miles above the lunar surface. It's almost unthinkable.
I feel so bad that as we're talking about this and the analogies that we're kind of describing, like exactly what's going on, my closest understanding is from watching and reading The Martian, is that like I'm always imagining what it was like when they were trying to get Mark Watney and they were trying to grab his hand and all of these things. But like in many ways, as much as that's highly fictionalized, there is that sort of similar stress of like, we're moving too fast, we're too far away, we have to course correct and we have to do it right at the right time, because otherwise we're not going to hit the target. And if you just miss it by a tiny bit, you really miss it by a lot, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is exaggerated. So a tiny mistake, 1,000 miles, over the Earth's surface becomes magnified unless there's corrections. So everything's dependent on communications, on the telemetry, on readings, and on the proper function of the spacecraft. And if they make any mistakes, the real hope is that they can slingshot around the moon. That was what they really believed in, that if something goes wrong near the moon, they can whip around it. Because the idea is once they get near the moon, they're going to have to use this single engine they have with them to enter lunar orbit and then later on to exit lunar orbit. They need that engine to make the orbit and not just slingshot around.
So that's the plan. It's not to just approach the moon, be whipped by, and be ejected back into space. The plan is to approach the moon at just the right speed and angle and everything that they actually get captured into the moon's orbit and make a few revolutions there to collect their data, to, you know, look in awe and wonder and to report back that they actually did that.
Exactly. It would have been dangerous enough just to fly around the moon, but they still would have qualified as the first human beings ever to reach the moon and would have dealt the Soviet Union a terrific blow in the space race, a devastating blow. But all of a sudden, the top managers at NASA, these incredibly brave, really genius guys, said, look, as long as we're going and we're going to use a Saturn V, we're going to do all this and go there, let's try to get into lunar orbit and let's get as close as we can and let's learn everything we can possibly learn about going to the moon, so that by the time we send the first lunar landing mission, they'll have the benefit of all this experience. So instead of just whipping around the moon, let's slow down, get captured by lunar gravity, orbit the moon 10 times over 20 hours. We'll scout landing locations for what would be Apollo 11. We'll do all kinds of other things. We'll learn how to go to the moon. We'll learn to do everything except land, and then we'll come back. It was a magnitudes more dangerous and risky to do the orbiting rather than just fly around. But they thought, as long as we're going, let's do it. Let's go for it.
Yeah, let's shoot for the moon, as they say. And so here they are. They're leaving Earth's orbit. They are making this this flight path towards the moon. And at this point, is anything going wrong? You know, you said that there were a few course corrections that they had to make, which is to be expected, and they had the tools to be able to do that. Was it pretty seamless getting then into the moon's orbit, or were there any issues that they had to overcome?
No, they had to overcome several issues, one of which was that Frank Borman, who had been flying since he was 15 years old and had never had a problem with sickness or anything aboard an airplane or a jet or an untested aircraft or his 14 days in space on Gemini 7, all of a sudden got very, very sick. Mm. And this was a big problem because his two crewmates had no idea why he was sick. Now, there was a Hong Kong flu that was killing thousands of people that year, and it was very possible that Borman had become infected or was suffering from the Hong Kong flu, but nobody knew. And to make matters more difficult, Borman insisted against his crewmates' better judgment that they do not report his sickness to mission control. Because Borman was highly suspicious of NASA's doctors. He believed, as did Lovell really, that the doctors often wanted to insinuate themselves into the space program and might call the mission back just to be part of it, to be, you know, have a say in things. And Borman would rather, he told me, have died, even if he was having a heart attack or whatever, he would have rather died and just been carried for the rest of the 6 days rather than turn back. So he ordered, and it's a military chain of command, even on the way to the moon, he ordered his two crewmates not to report this. But things just got worse and worse. The cabin was filled with vomit and feces, and it was a terrible situation. But the real threat was that the other two could become sick. And if you have three sick astronauts on the way to the moon, who've never been to the moon, this could be a real serious problem. So finally, they figured an ingenious way to report the sickness to mission control without the public hearing it and without it being broadcast on the squawk boxes. And when they did that, the doctors came together with the top managers at NASA, and they very nearly turned this flight around.
How did they do it? Did they use some sort of code?
They dictated the problem on a channel that could be downloaded to mission control on via tape that would have to be played back rather than listened to live. It was on, I think it was broadcast on the actual channel that they used for television broadcasts. That's my memory, at least.
That's fascinating.
But mission control didn't even understand what was being asked of them for several hours because it was, it was so unusual. And it was such a kind of an ingenious but unorthodox plan. But when they finally heard it, it was a very big problem, an emergency, and they all got together and it came very close to turning this thing around.
Wow. Okay. So I remember once having a chat with Don Pettit, and I think it was it Dan Burbank? It was another astronaut while they were together at the ISS. And I had the, you know, amazing opportunity to interview them live. And I remember asking, I think it was actually Don, what happens if you get sick in space? Like, how do you deal with it? What happens if you have to barf? Because we know that it'll like just fly everywhere and clog everything up. And he was like, you swallow it. Like, you don't barf. Like, no matter what, you just work really hard not to barf. But of course, as you mentioned, this guy was so incredibly sick, he couldn't control it. And so, you know, it's something as small as a technical issue on, you know, it's bad enough to be sick on Earth. When you're like, you can hardly make it to the toilet. There is no toilet. There is no vertical. There is no gravity at this point.
No.
How did they deal with it?
The only saving grace in this situation was that Borman started to come around and feel better. So NASA and the doctors predicted that this was somehow related to motion sickness rather than to the Hong Kong flu or to some kind of contagion. And so they really rolled the dice, betting that not only would Borman improve, but that the other two hadn't been made sick also. Because as I said, if you got three sick astronauts on this flight, you have a huge amount of trouble. And so they bet on Borman coming around further, and their bet paid off.
I love it. Even your answer was so utilitarian. They're like, he wasn't really sick. He was actually just had really bad kind of motion sickness. He got past it. And I'm like, yeah, but they're all still covered in vomit. Like, how did they deal? What did they do about that? They just kind of dealt with it and worked through it?
They had to deal with it. And Anders is so poetic in describing how the vomit would float through the cabin, and that he saw so many of Newton's laws demonstrated in the way things moved and split apart and the conservation of momentum and all kinds of things.
It's a non-Newtonian fluid, right? Like it's semi-solid and semi-liquid.
Yeah. And he, I mean, I put his description in the book almost word for word because it was so beautiful. I know that sounds crazy, but he's such a beautiful explainer that it was fascinating to listen to. But at the same time, he was enraptured by this whole demonstration. He was also being made sick from it. And so he went for the oxygen, and Lovell reminded him, hey, that's just for emergencies. And Anders said, this is an emergency. And he took the oxygen and because they just couldn't take it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to die, you need the oxygen, but also maybe we shouldn't all start puking. Like that's, right, exactly. That's an emergency too.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay. So this is all happening while they're slingshotting out of Earth's or while they're boosting out of Earth's orbit and they're approaching the moon. Once they enter into the moon's orbit, has he kind of quelled this illness or is it still going on?
Oh yeah, he's fine. By the time they are approaching the moon, he's good to go. And again, this is one of those things that they just didn't know what to expect because like everything else on this mission, this is for the first time. So man had never flown to the moon. They didn't know what to expect. So, but by the time they do start approaching the moon, Borman is A-okay. The others are fine. And a lot of history is about to be made.
All right. So they're approaching the moon. They've kind of, you know, they're breathing deeply now. They're past the vomit. They're, you know, about to do the first, you know, they're about to go someplace where humankind has never gone before. As they're entering the atmosphere of the moon, what's going on? How are they, you know, how are they coping with it? How are they experiencing it?
Well, one of the things that was stunning to me is that they're all kind of bewildered because this whole time they have not seen the moon. And they report to Houston, you know, as of yet, we've not seen the moon. And I think they were kind of expecting to see the spacecraft approached the moon in the way they'd seen it in 2001, A Space Odyssey, which came out in April of 1968. Borman, I think alone among astronauts, didn't watch that film. That gets at so much of what's so nice about his character. He's very focused on business. He views this as a total military operation, Kara. To him, this is all about defeating the Soviets. He doesn't have time for science fiction movies. But boy, Lovell and Anders did, and they loved 2001 A Space Odyssey. And if you have a chance to go on YouTube or to see the approach of the spacecraft to the moon, it's so beautiful. Even 50 years later, it's breathtaking to watch. And that's kind of what they were expecting. And in reality, Anders described it to Houston as kind of like sitting in a submarine in the depths of the ocean. They just didn't see anything. But that would change as they got real close.
And then all of a sudden, like, pow, it's there.
It's there. Anders sees the outside, he's looking at a million stars outside the window, and all of a sudden everything goes dark. And he believes that oil is being streaked across the windows. It doesn't make sense, but that's what it seems like. But then he realizes it's not oil, it's the moon. And not only is it the moon, it's the far side of the moon, because we only see the near side on Earth. We always see the same side. But here, the first human eyes are beholding the far side of the moon, and they just can't believe it. They have arrived.
And so, you know, the reason that we see the near side of the moon here on Earth is because we're tidally locked with the moon. It doesn't, it moves in the same kind of cadence as the Earth moves. And so that's the side that's lit up by the sun from our perspective. But what does it look like to approach the far side from space?
Well, they only know what they've seen from in these grainy black and white photos taken by unmanned probes.
Mm-hmm.
But what they see is completely different than what they're expecting. It's very rocky and mountainous and jagged. And
oh God, how scary.
And you know, they have a very specific flight plan that they're supposed to be paying attention to. But Lovell says when they get to the far side of the moon, they're like three kids. He describes it as three kids with their noses pressed up against a candy store window. You know, they've trained for this. They know what they're doing. This is the whole idea of the Apollo program, is to deliver men to the moon, but they just can't believe it. It's magnificent and stunning, unexpected, all at once. They are the first human beings ever to arrive at a new world, and they can't take their eyes off it.
And so was the Saturn V equipped with photography equipment? Were they expected to take photographs or video? Was there remote shuttered photography, or is there just kind of no footage?
Well, everything you bring in the command module, it's so small, has to count. Frank Borman argued, believe it or not, can you believe this, Kara, that he argued vociferously against bringing TV cameras on this mission because he thought our job is to get there first, defeat the Soviets, and get back. later on, we're going to find out that one of the TV broadcasts they made may be the most famous in history and maybe the most important. But one of the things that was very important to NASA, in addition to TV coverage, was photography. And that responsibility fell to Bill Anders. He was charged with photography, and he had a lot of photographic responsibility. So he learns to use these advanced cameras and lenses, and he knows exactly what he's supposed to be doing. And some of it's very primitive. He has to set light meters based on the time of day and just the calculations that the engineers made about lighting at the moon at that time.
And yeah, this was not like, you know, pull out your iPhone, slap an Instagram filter on it. This is a very different time when photography equipment used film.
Film and tons of film. They're going to take an incredible number of photographs, one of which is going to be, in my estimation, and I know many people agree with me, the single most important photograph ever taken.
And what is that photograph?
Well, on the fourth revolution that Apollo 8 is making around the moon, Borman changes the orientation of the aircraft, and suddenly they're looking out over the lunar horizon. And in front of them, all they see is the gray kind of featureless landscape of the moon, and beyond it, a black infinity of the universe that goes on forever. So it's gray and black and gray and black. And all of a sudden, completely to their astonishment, a little bit of blue starts to rise over the lunar horizon, and a little bit more. And all of a sudden, they realize that what they're seeing is the Earth rising over the lunar horizon. And they scramble like mad to get their cameras. Borman actually gets the first shot of this Earthrise, but he gets it in black and white. But Anders, who's the photographer, has color film, and he's got the best lens for his camera. And the guys, you should hear the broadcast of this. They're talking to each other like little kids, like, oh my God, that is so beautiful. Can you believe that? They were beside themselves. But Anders has the presence of mind to fire off these long shots of Earthrise, this beautiful blue jewel on which everything that they knew and everything we knew exists. This tiny, gorgeous jewel set against an infinity of black outer space, he captures this Earthrise. And each man would describe to me that they'd never be the same again after they saw that everything they held dear, everyone they loved, everything they cared about, everything they ever knew was on that tiny blue jewel. And they captured it, and they never had prepared for that. They had studied only to take photographs of the moon and study the moon and learn the moon. And as Anders said to me, we had come all this way and done all this to arrive at the moon, but what we had really found was the Earth. And it changed them. And this photograph, Earthrise, that Bill Anders took would become what remains to this day maybe the most important and powerful and famous photograph ever taken. It was put on, you know, millions and millions of postage stamps. It's the inspiration for the first Earth Day, for the environmental movement. And when you see books, for example, that say, here are the most 100 most important photographs of the 20th century, Earthrise is not just included, it's on the cover. It is the first time human beings ever looked back at themselves as a whole. And it just was a moment of amazing power.
I'm looking at it right now. I just pulled it up from, you know, the NASA official kind of website. And of course, I know this photo. Everybody knows this photo. And I guess I just had no idea that this photo was taken in 1968 from, you know, this tiny capsule that was whipping through the moon's orbit, and that they were able to capture this with, you know, that old photographic film in such precarious kind of circumstances. And it really is just stunning. I guess I'm so used to seeing what Earth looks like from the ISS. And this really does show you just how freaking far away they really were.
They really were. And they're taking a photograph of the Earth at the very, very end of one of the worst years in our country's history. And they're looking back at this beautiful, blue, delicate jewel with this tiny atmosphere that protects us all. And they're thinking, all three of them, in their own ways, and they each describe it beautifully, they're thinking, we all need each other. We're all on the same tiny little island in this vast infinity of space, and we're one. And it just hit them all of a sudden like that, and none of them would ever be the same after it for it.
I can only imagine what this did for the public consciousness at that time. What a kind of reversal of of emotion probably took place. How long did it take for this photograph to be, you know, developed? Obviously, they couldn't just download it the way that we can now. No, they had to get home, and they had to get home safely. And then they had to, you know, develop the film before they could make it public. So was it quite a while between the mission and kind of showing this to the world?
No, I think it took them less than a week. But everything, when Apollo 8 got back, NASA knew that it had something, you know, once in human existence mm-hmm. on its hands. This is the first time we're looking back at ourselves. And so they took no chances. They developed everything by hand. And when they saw these Earthrise pictures, they were as moved back in the photo lab as the astronauts had been at the moon. They just couldn't believe what they were looking at. And they selected what they believed was the best one, and they published it. And within a week of Apollo 8's return, it was on the front pages of virtually every magazine and newspaper in the world.
Ugh, it's just incredible. And so, of course, there's a lot of gaps to fill in between. I've kept you already an hour, so I don't want to keep you too much longer, but we've left it at the moon, where they're taking this incredible photo, where they're experiencing for the first time the wonder and the awe of looking back at our home planet in its entirety from a perspective that nobody on the planet has ever had personally. I mean, this is a momentous occasion for all of humankind, but then it must occur to them at some point, we got to get home.
Right. But right before they get home, before they're scheduled to go home, they have to make the third television broadcast of the four of them planned for the whole mission. And this one's going to occur on Christmas Eve. And they were told before they left by NASA managers that more people would be listening to their voice at one time than had ever heard a human voice in history. Nearly one third of the world's population would tune in live to this. And they were given no more instruction on what to say than say something appropriate. And Borman, it's so fun to hear Borman describe today. He says, can you imagine that happening today? It would go through 23 committees and up through the channels, and it would be, you know, combed over every single word. Nothing. They just left it to the astronauts. And the astronauts felt the weight of the importance of this thing. They would be speaking to a third of the world from a new world. And so they tried their best to come up with something appropriate, but they were having no luck. Borman turned over the assignment to a literary and sensitive man that he knew, but that man had no luck either. He in turn turned it over to another literary man who also had no luck. But about 2:30 in the morning, that third man's wife came in and saw all these crumbled up pieces of paper on the guy's floor, her husband's floor. And she said, what do you need? And he explained, you know, we need something appropriate. They're going to be speaking to the world. And she came up with an idea that when it was communicated back to Borman, Lovell, and Anders, they knew instantly that it was exactly right. They wrote it down in fireproof paper, put it in the flight plan, never thought about it again. They didn't tell NASA. They didn't tell their wives. They didn't tell anyone. But here comes the broadcast on Christmas Eve, and everyone's listening across the world. And first, the astronauts are giving a tour of the moon. They're showing certain craters. They're describing what their time at the moon's been like, and they're going to try to go home soon. And then in the very last moments of the broadcast, they go to read from their fireproof paper, and they begin reading from the first lines from the book of Genesis, in the beginning, and nobody across the world could believe what was happening. It was the most powerful thing. People would tell you, even now, 50 years later, who remember it, it was the most impactful, emotional thing they'd ever heard. It spoke to so many religions across the world. It was an origin story, and it was being spoken at the moon on Christmas Eve. And it was so moving to people that by the time Borman read the last lines of it, and wished people on the good earth a Merry Christmas, people all over the world flocked outside from their homes, from restaurants, from their jobs, and looked into the sky, knowing that they couldn't see the Apollo 8 command module, but looking all the same, because nothing had ever moved them like this. This was the perfect thing to say at the perfect time at the end of a terrible, terrible year. And by the time Apollo 8 returned a few days later, the world, and certainly America, seemed different for the flight. You know, when Apollo 8 launched, Time magazine had already chosen the dissenter as its man of the year. But by the time Apollo 8 returned, they changed to the crew of Apollo 8. That's an honor that Time magazine wouldn't even bestow on Apollo 11, the first people to walk on the moon. Wow. So this was a hugely, hugely important thing. And when Apollo 8 splashed down on December 27th, 1968, there didn't seem to be a person in all of America who didn't believe, who wasn't convinced that something beautiful, something miraculous, and something even impossible had occurred. The whole country was brought together by the flight. People who couldn't have endured a moment with each other before the flight came together. And this was something that united the country. The Apollo 8 crew went on several ticker tape parades. Millions of people showed up, more than a million people here in Chicago, where I live, and city after city. And they were overflowing with congratulatory letters and telegrams. But the crew got one telegram they never forgot. It came from an anonymous stranger, I think from the Midwest. And it was only four words long, but they never forgot it. And it said, "Thanks, you saved 1968. And that's how that's how it all ended.
Oh, gosh, what an incredible story. And the way that you tell it is just so magical. Like, if you, everybody listening, if he, and you know he is half as good a writer as you are an orator, you guys, you have to check out this book. It's called Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon, Robert Kersen. Robert, thank you so much for joining me. I have to ask, before I let you go, and I know I've kept you too long already, I close my podcast each week by asking my guests the same final two questions. And they're really big picture questions. But of course, you've had your mind on these really big picture issues for quite some time in working on this book. So I would love to get your personal answer to these questions, if you don't mind.
Of course.
All right. So I want you to think about the future now, not the past, but the future. And I want you to put it into whatever context is relevant to you right now. It could be the future of, you know, our relationship with the planet, the future of kind of humanity and how we get along, or even something more personal, the future of you, your family, your career. But what I want you to tell me is, first, what is the thing that you really find yourself preoccupied with that's keeping you up most nights, that's, you know, maybe you're quite pessimistic about, you're worried about, the thing that's most disconcerting to you? But then on the flip side of that, I would also love to know what it is that you're optimistic about, that you really are looking quite forward to.
Well, I think on the pessimistic side, and I'm 55 now, I just turned 55 last week. And so I'm beginning to really stare my mortality in the face. And so the thing that keeps me up at night is the idea of non-existence and the idea that I don't think the human mind is capable of contemplating non-existence. I think we can contemplate eternal darkness or eternal silence, but those are experiences we have as living creatures. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we can contemplate non-existence. And it's very frightening and disconcerting to me. At the same time, the thing I'm optimistic about is kind of related to that, and that is that I think human beings are capable of doing things that are unimaginable today, and Apollo 8 was part of what helped me believe in that. Going to the moon and landing on the moon and doing that when we did it was just unthinkable, and yet we were capable of it. We needed a push. We needed, really, in my opinion, to feel that our very existence was threatened, that we might not exist if we didn't do it. So that push from the idea of non-existence is very scary, but it's very, very powerful. And I think that if the country or the world faces that kind of thing again, we can do things that we not only can't imagine now, but that we would insist were absolutely impossible. And that excites me, even though I likely won't be around for it in the end.
Oh, so beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing these insights with us, for sharing this incredible story with the world that, you know, I think that we're just at that age. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary, right? So we're just at that age where for some people, this is a beautiful piece of nostalgia. And for other people, they're going to be learning about this important aspect of our history for the very first time. So I just have to thank you once again for sharing it with us and for joining me today to tell this beautiful story.
I can't thank you enough. This was such a pleasure to me. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, excellent. So guys, thank you for coming back week after week as well. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.